from Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
With respect to 9/11, of course, you've had the story that's been public out there. The Czechs alleged that Mohammed Atta, the lead attacker, met in Prague with a senior Iraqi intelligence official 5 months before the attack.
How many times can a lie be repeated before people accept it as fact? Today, we look at Cheney's statements as the vice president goes on the offensive. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal appeals court yesterday ordered the October 7th gubernatorial recall vote in California to be postponed, likely until March 2nd. The three-judge panel unanimously ruled voters in six counties would be disenfranchised if they were forced to use antiquated punch card voting machines similar to the ones used in the Florida presidential election 2000. Experts say that votes cast using the punch card system are 2.5 times more likely not to register than votes used on more modern equipment. The court decision is expected to be appealed and may quickly land at the Supreme Court. The appeals court decision was based primarily on the findings of the high court in the Bush versus Gore case, which stopped the recount of Florida's votes in 2000. The Los Angeles Times reports the delay raises additional questions for the state, including whether to count the 100,000 ballots already submitted by absentee voters and whether new candidates would be allowed to join the race. It'll also force candidates to prepare for a six-month campaign versus a six-week campaign. Political analysts say Gray Davis, the Democratic governor who faces recall, stands to benefit most from the delay. Many Republicans protested the court's decision, including Daryl Issa, the state legislator who bankrolled the recall drive. Issa called the ruling an example of, quote, judicial hijacking. He noted all three judges on the panel were appointed by Democratic presidents. CNN's top war correspondent Christiane Amanpour has admitted CNN reporters practiced self-censorship during the invasion and failed to ask enough questions about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction beforehand. Speaking on the program Topic with Tina Brown, Amanpour said, quote, I think the press was muzzled, and I think the press self-muzzled. I'm sorry to say, but certainly television and perhaps to a certain extent my station was intimidated by the administration and its foot soldiers at Fox News. She went on to say, quote, and it did, in fact, put a climate of fear and self-censorship, in my view, in terms of the kind of broadcast work we did. In response to Amanpour's comments, a spokesperson for Fox said, quote, given the choice, it's better to be viewed as a foot soldier for Bush than a spokeswoman for al-Qaeda. In news from Iraq, the police chief of the Iraqi city Qaldia was killed yesterday after his convoy was ambushed during a daylight attack. A week ago, police officers complained to the Washington Post they faced increasing accusations from residents that the police had become collaborators with the U.S. occupying forces. A top Bush administration official, John Bolton, is planning to testify today before Congress that Syria has an ambitious program to develop chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. New York Times reporter Judith Miller obtained a draft of Bolton's statements in which he suggests Syria is partly responsible for the ongoing attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq because he claims Syria has failed to stop militants from entering and fighting in Iraq. Bolton is also expected to testify that Syria, quote, is a stockpile of the nerve agent sarin that can be delivered by aircraft or ballistic missiles and is engaged in the research and development of more toxic and persistent nerve agents such as VX. The Zimbabwe government has shut down the country's only independent daily newspaper, The Daily News, for refusing to register with the government-appointed Media and Information Commission. In Chechnya, 3 people died, 25 were injured when a bomb exploded outside the headquarters of a Russian security service base. Coming under international criticism, the Israeli government reversed itself yesterday, claimed the government's official policy on controlling Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat does not include the option of assassinating him. On Sunday, Israel's Vice Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said, quote, "Arafat can no longer be a factor in what happens here. The question is, how are we going to do it? Expulsion is certainly one of the options, and killing is also one of the options." In election news, retired Army General Wesley Clark is meeting with political fundraising and legal advisors in Arkansas to discuss possibly joining the presidential race. An announcement is expected tomorrow or Thursday. Clark has been urged to run from grassroots organizers of the Draft Clark movement, as well as celebrities, including filmmaker Michael Moore. The Washington Post reports former President Bill Clinton will also encourage Clark to run. In other campaign news, Senator John Kerry's communications director, Chris Lahani, has resigned, citing differences in the direction of Kerry's campaign. The Associated Press reports the resignation may mark the beginning of a wider shakeup in the Kerry team. Attorney General John Ashcroft has continued his defense of the Patriot Act by charging librarians are fueling, quote, baseless hysteria by warning library patrons about the government's power to subpoena library records. Speaking before the American Restaurant Association, Ashcroft claimed the government, quote, has no interest in your reading habits. Tracking reading habits would betray our high regard for the First Amendment, he said. Under the Patriot Act, federal agents are given the power to secretly demand records from librarians and booksellers about patrons. The New York Times reports it's not known how many times this aspect of the law has been used because the information is classified, and librarians are bound by a gag order to tell no one if and when records are requested. They can be prosecuted if they say the FBI has approached them and asked for records. In sports news, the Women's United Soccer Association, a 3-year-old professional soccer league, has been forced to fold due to lack of corporate sponsors. And the Senate is expected to vote today to roll back the new media ownership laws approved by the Federal Communications Commission 3 months ago. And music legend Johnny Cash was buried yesterday in Tennessee. He died last week at the age of 71.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black for those who've never read or listened to the words that Jesus said about the road to happiness through love and charity. Why, you think he's talking straight to you and me? Well, we're doing mighty fine, I do suppose, in our streak of lightning cars and fancy clothes. But just so we're reminded of the ones who are held back, up front there ought to be a man in black. The sick and lonely old, for the reckless ones whose bad trip left them cold. I wear the black in mourning for the lives that could have been. Each week we lose 100 fine young men, and I wear it for the thousands who have died, believing that the Lord was on their
Johnny Cash here on Democracy Now! the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In his first televised interview in 6 months, Vice President Dick Cheney went on the offensive to justify the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. In a lengthy interview on NBC's Meet the Press, Cheney portrayed Iraq as, quote, the geographic base for the September 11th attacks. In attempting to sell the reasons for war against Baghdad, Cheney repeated many allegations about Iraq that have been proven false over the past 2 years. Today, we'll spend the hour dissecting some of the vice president's statement. His story that one of the 911 hijackers, Mohammed Atta, met with Iraqi intelligence officers in Prague. What Cheney said about the Iraqi-American who went to Iraq after the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. There's a $25 million price on his head. But when Saddam Hussein offered to hand him over, the Bush administration said no. They also did not include him in the playing cards of the most wanted men in Iraq. Also, we'll look at the U.S. authorized flights of the bin Laden family and more than 100 other Saudis soon after September 11th, when all other flights had been grounded. But we're going to begin with Cheney's discussion and Tim Russert's questioning on Meet the Press of the vice president of Niger's link to the alleged Iraq nuclear program. Let's take a listen.
Now, Ambassador Joe Wilson, a year before that, was sent over by the CIA because you raised the question about uranium from Africa. He says he came back from Niger and said that, in fact, he could not find any documentation that, in fact, Niger had sent uranium to Iraq or engaged in that connectivity and reported it back to the proper channels. Were you briefed on his findings in February, March of 2002?
No. I don't know Joe Wilson. I've never met Joe Wilson. A question had arisen. I'd heard a report that the Iraqis had been trying to acquire uranium in Africa, Niger in particular. I get a daily brief on my own each day before I meet with the president to go through the intel. And I ask lots of questions. One of the questions I ask at that particular time about this, I said, you know, what do we know about this? They take the question. He came back within a day or two and said, this is all we know. There's a lot we don't know. End of statement. And Joe Wilson, I don't know who sent Joe Wilson. He never submitted a report that I ever saw when he came back. I guess the intriguing thing, Tim, on the whole thing, this question of whether or not the Iraqis were trying to acquire uranium in Africa in the British report. This week, the committee of the British Parliament that just spent 90 days investigating all of this revalidated the British claim that Saddam was, in fact, trying to acquire uranium in Africa. What was in the State of the Union speech and what was in the original British white paper. So there may be a difference of opinion there. I don't know what the truth is on the ground with respect to that. But I guess, saying I don't know Mr. Wilson, I probably shouldn't judge him. I have no idea who hired him, and it never
came. The CIA did.
Yeah, but who in the CIA? I don't know.
That is Dick Cheney talking about the Iraq-Niger link on Tim Russert's Meet the Press this weekend. Well, we are joined today by Joseph Wilson, the retired U.S. diplomat, the former acting U.S. ambassador to Iraq under President Bush Sr. The CIA sent Wilson to investigate the uranium claim in Niger. He found it highly unlikely. Despite this, the uranium Niger claim became a key piece of the administration's justification for the war. 1 month after Bush declared that major combat operations were over in Iraq, Wilson wrote a stinging op-ed piece that was published in the New York Times in early July. In it, he said he told the CIA long before the president's January speech that the British reports were suspect. This set off a firestorm around Bush's address. 1 week later, public syndicated columnist Robert Novak quoted anonymous government sources as telling him that Wilson's wife was a CIA operative working on the issue of weapons of mass destruction. Lawmakers, including New York Senator Charles Schumer, have decried the report, saying the leak effectively burned the wife's cover if she were in fact a covert agent, and are calling for an investigation. Blowing a CIA agent's cover is a felony. Ambassador Joseph Wilson joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you?
It's very good to have you with us. Well, let's talk first about what Vice President Cheney said about your Niger claim and his relationship with you and what kind of report you brought back from Niger.
Well, first of all, the Vice President's absolutely right. We've never met. He was Secretary of Defense when I was in charge of our embassy in Baghdad, and as one of the principals of the National Security Council, he was certainly in National Security Council meetings chaired by President Bush when discussions were being held on reports that I was submitting on a regular basis from Baghdad. So while we've never met, he certainly knows who I am or should know who I am unless his memory is flawed or faulty. The important thing, though, is to understand that it was not just the report that I brought back that was part of the U.S. government's information base. There was also a report from our sitting ambassador on the ground in Niamey. She had gone and consulted with the current government officials. My own report dealt with previous government officials who had been in office at the time that this purported sale of uranium had been agreed to. And there was also a report submitted to the U.S. government by a four-star Marine Corps general who had traveled to Niamey before I had gone there. So in our government files, there were at a minimum three reports that had been generated shortly after the president asked the question, what do we know, or vice president asked the question, what do we know about this? So the interesting thing, it seems to me, is how is it that these bogus documents that were not credible enough to be included in an Italian tabloid publication, how did the essence of these documents end up in the State of the Union address? Now, the vice president can talk about the so-called British white paper, and the British can say, well, we had specific information that we could not share with the U.S. government because of rules relating to the exchange of information with third parties. But the fact is, the United States spends billions of dollars on intelligence every year, and it's not likely that we're going to subcontract our analysis of intelligence to the British, with all due respect to their own intelligence capabilities. So, moreover, the President's State of the Union address is, of course, the most important speech that he gives in any given year, and this was a particularly important speech in a particularly important year because it dealt with issues of war and peace. So how the question remains in my mind is not whether or not the analysis was correct or the reports were correct, it was not just mine but all the others. The question is, how did such a statement which could not be substantiated, which was not based on our own intelligence, which was not based on facts as we knew them, end up in the president's speech? The vice president didn't answer that question.
The vice president said that no report was submitted. Is that true? Did you submit
not.
A report?
Of course not. And the vice president knows that. There is evidence of a circular cable that was sent around as a consequence of my report. In addition to which, I would go back to what I've said repeatedly, and that is that if you are senior enough to ask the question, and the vice president acknowledged, I think, for the first time personally that he had asked the question, if you're senior enough to ask the question, you are senior enough to get an answer. And an answer does not mean that the briefer comes back to you 2 days later and says, gee, boss, we don't know anything more about this. The answer means that the agency to whom the question is addressed goes out and tries to determine whether or not they can dig up more and additional information to either validate or discredit the report about which the vice president has asked.
So you did file a report?
Of course. I did an oral report within an hour of my return, in addition to which I briefed both the ambassador and somebody else at the embassy before I even left Niamey. And I briefed the CIA within an hour of my return from 8 days over Niger.
So he lied when he said you didn't file a report.
Well, I think I'm not sure he lied. It's hard to say in what form that report would have been given to him. And certainly if it was a written report, my own particular identity would not have been revealed to him. So he may not necessarily have attached my name to a report that he received on the subject. Again, his memory may be faulty on this.
But given the furor that has erupted over the, quote, 16-word statement in Bush's State of the Union address alleging the link between Iraq and Niger and the uranium sale, this certainly would have been investigated to this point right now, by now.
Well, I can't say that. I don't know. There would be three ways that the vice president would receive an answer to the question he raised. One would be a telephone conversation. One would be an oral briefing, which may or may not have included talking points. And the third would have been a more formal memorandum. And I just simply don't know how the agency determined the best way to brief the vice president on the contents of my report. Or, for that matter, how the vice president was briefed on the other two reports, one from the ambassador and one from this four-star Marine general.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to Ambassador Joseph Wilson. We'll be back in a minute. Eyes never lie. Dwayne Wiggins here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion with Ambassador Joseph Wilson. He's the retired U.S. diplomat who was sent on a CIA-sponsored mission to investigate the allegation that Niger had sold uranium to Saddam Hussein. He came back saying that the documents on which this claim was based were bogus, were forged. Cheney talked about him this weekend. The vice president talked about him on Meet the Press, saying he didn't know Joseph Wilson, that he had not filed a report. He also said that he didn't know who had sent you, raising questions about the whole legitimacy of your mission to Niger.
Yeah, I heard that. I don't know what the vice president was trying to get at in that. I mean, I'm not sure that he answered that series of questions particularly well. Let me make one point, however, that the gist of my trip out to Niger was to look into whether or not such a transaction could happen. And what I looked into was not forged documents, because I had not seen the documents. I had been given an oral briefing on what they contained. I looked into how the business is structured and how the bureaucracy, which would cover such an agreement, which would have been a legitimate, if discreet, sale from one sovereign government to another. I looked into how the bureaucracy covering that sale worked and how the documents would have been prepared. When I returned, I said that both from an industry perspective, because of the nature of the business, and from a government decision-making perspective, it was highly unlikely that such a sale had taken place. If it had taken place, or if the documents that covered this sale, these documents we presumably had or had seen, did not contain certain signatures, then those documents could not be authentic.
Now to the other issue, which is Robert Novak, the syndicated columnist, saying that your wife is a CIA operative working on the issue of weapons of mass destruction. Quoting two senior administration officials told me his wife suggested sending Wilson to Niger to investigate the Italian report. The CIA says its counterproliferation officials selected Wilson and asked his wife to contact him. This issue of outing a CIA operative, your response?
Well, it's I mean, clearly, if my wife were as Novak asserted, it would be a violation of American law, as you correctly pointed out in your introduction. It's the Intelligence Agent Identification Act. It dates back to 1982, and there are, you know, clear criminal charges that would have to be brought after an investigation, which is conducted first by the CIA and then referred to the Justice Department and the FBI for further investigation. That's you know, if she were as Novak asserted. If she isn't, it is still, you know, something of an embarrassment, to say the least. I'm not sure that, you know, our family security is necessarily threatened by this, but it's certainly an embarrassment for her because she has to, you know, sort of talk to all her friends and people that she's known over the past 20 years, and explain to them why what Novak said is or is not true. I mean, my bottom line on this is that for an administration that came to office promising to restore honor and dignity to the White House, what they did with respect to my wife was neither honorable nor was it dignified. In fact, it has really very little to do with me. It has nothing to do with her. This whole thing has nothing to do with her. The attack on her, and by extension, the attempts to sort of launch attacks on me or discredit my credibility are clearly designed to intimidate others from coming forward, and I've said that repeatedly. People who might be willing to come forward, those who had said that they had felt pressured, they had said so anonymously to the press, might have been contemplating coming forward to talk to their congressman about this. They'll think twice about it after having seen, you know, the Novak allegation about my wife.
I wanted to turn for a minute to the White House press briefing reporter questioning the White House press secretary, Scott McClellan.
Robert Novak column last week identified the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson as a CIA operative who was working on WMD issues. Novak said that identification is based on information given to him by two administration sources. That column has now given rise to accusations that the administration deliberately blew the cover of an undercover CIA operative, and in so doing violated a federal law that prohibits the revealing the identity of undercover CIA operatives. Can you respond to that?
Thank you for bringing that up. That is not the way this president or this White House operates, and there is absolutely no information that has come to my attention or that I have seen that suggests that there is any truth to that suggestion. And certainly no one in this White House would have been given authority to take such a step. I'm saying that that is not the way that this president or this White House operates, and I've seen no evidence to suggest there's any truth to it.
Are you saying Novak is wrong in saying that these two administration sources who were his source?
I have no idea who anonymous is. I often wish that would be anonymous. Whether it's anonymous senior administration officials or just anonymous sources, it's still anonymous.
Is Novak lying? Do you think he's making it up?
I'm telling you our position. I'll let the columnist speak for himself. But
flatly, it did not happen. Nobody.
I'm telling you flatly that is not the way this White House operates. I've seen no evidence to suggest that there's any truth to that.
From saying it didn't happen. Are you saying absolutely it did not happen?
I'm saying no one was certainly given any authority to do anything of that nature, and I've seen no evidence to suggest there's any truth to it. I want to make it very clear that is simply not the way this White House operates.
If it turns out that somebody in the administration did do that,
well, I'm not even speculating about it because I have no knowledge of any truth to that report.
What's the extent of your knowledge, then? Don't you want to get some more facts? I mean, how do you know that no one in the administration, Robert Novak's been around
if
for
I could
a
go
long?
Find anonymous, Terry, I would.
Ambassador Wilson, this whole issue of who anonymous it is, the discussion has been going on the internet. You also raised the issue in the Washington Forum with Congressmember Inslee. The name Karl Rove has been thrown about quite a bit, and you also raised that. Just wanted to play that comment.
Sure.
Well, Mr. Wilson, assuming what Robert Novak said about your wife was true and the seriousness of that, can we expect the FBI to give a complete, unhindered investigation into that? And find out wherever it leads to?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that. Because we're talking in hypotheticals, the way the process works is if this were to have been true, the CIA will do an internal investigation and determine whether or not, in their judgment, a law has been broken. They then refer to the Justice Department who takes another look at it, and then it's referred to the FBI for further investigation. Now, despite the fact that John Ashcroft's in charge of the Justice Department, this violation, if it is in fact a violation, is one that is a violation of a professional. And the investigation and the look into this will be done essentially by professionals. Now, there is a lot of interest in Congress. Henry Waxman has been keenly interested in this and offered all sorts of support. Chuck Schumer, Mr. Gun Control, came out and made a statement to the effect that if true, this was like putting a gun to the head of an agent. John Dean, of all people, just wrote the other day that the president should have extended a Secret Service protection to me and my family as a consequence of this. He didn't, by the way. I must say. Although I will tell you, I think they're scared to death that I might stub my toe. I have confidence that at the professional level that whatever they think is doable will be done. My own sense is that, and I've told the FBI this, that should they decide to undertake an investigation, that I want to talk with them to see how I can best support the investigation, not do anything to impede it. And I think I do have a vote in this, since Congress has basically said we'll do anything we can to support you. And the question is whether or not having Chuck Schumer and Hillary and others go forward and talk about this openly, Dick Durbin, impedes or helps the investigation down the road. But we'll see. I mean, I don't think we're going to let this drop. At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs. And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
What did you mean by that when you say you measure your words? And what leads you to believe Karl Rove is the source for, well, I know you can't talk about what your wife does, but for saying that your wife is a CIA operative?
Well, first of all, if you go back and you take a look at the Novak article, it quotes two senior administration sources. That basically is code for the White House. And these sorts of things, the press office, Scott McClellan, was absolutely denying that he knew anything about it or had any knowledge of what may have happened. That doesn't leave too many offices within the White House that would be interested in this. The political office is obviously the next place to look. Now, my own sense is, as I said in those comments, is that I want to make sure that the appropriate investigation is done, and that it leads in the direction that it leads wherever it may lead to find out who was responsible for this, if in fact the assertion in Novak's article was accurate.
We contacted the FBI yesterday and asked if they're doing an investigation. They said they are looking into the matter but would not classify it as an investigation yet. We had called the White House first, but they said to call the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
These kinds of issues, when someone charges that a person has had their cover blown, are usually investigated right away. Do you have any sense that, in fact, this is seriously being investigated right now? And would it take an act of Congress for that to take place in the Bush administration?
Well, first of all, let me just make very clear that it's not at all certain that my wife is as Novak asserted. I mean, it is not something that is in the public domain. But if the allegation is accurate, I have every confidence that the relevant agencies that have jurisdiction over this matter are looking into it. These things take some time, and we'll just see where it goes.
Would you say a very strong message is being sent to others who speak out, as you have after submitting your report?
Oh, I've said that all along. I've said that it was very clear to me that the intent of this attack was not to shut me up. Now, there may have been some desire to somehow impugn my integrity, which is, you know, just how the game is played here in Washington. But it was the intent was clearly to intimidate others and keep others from stepping forward.
Well, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, we want to thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move to another excerpt from Vice President Dick Cheney's statement this week. Some might call it lie number two. Let's take a listen.
Vanity Fair magazine reports that about 140 Saudis were allowed to leave the United States the day after the 11th, allowed to leave our airspace, and were never investigated by the FBI. And that departure was approved by high-level administration figures. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, but a lot of folks from that part of the world left in the aftermath of 9/11 because they were worried about public reaction here in the United States or that somehow they might be discriminated against. So we have had, especially since the attacks in Riyadh in May of this year from the Saudi government, great support and cooperation in going after terrorists, especially al-Qaeda. I think the Saudis came to realize as a result of the attacks of last May that they were as much of a target as we are, that al-Qaeda did have a foothold inside Saudi Arabia. A number of the members of the organization are from there, that there have been private individuals in Saudi Arabia who provided significant financial support and assistance, that there are facilitators and operators working inside Saudi Arabia to support the al-Qaeda network. And the Saudis have been, as I say, in the last several months, very good partners in helping us go after the people in the al-Qaeda organization.
Dick Cheney speaking this Sunday. Well, in the days after the September 11th attacks, former Vice President Al Gore was grounded. Former President Bill Clinton was grounded. Planes were forced down in mid-flight, including one carrying a heart to be transplanted to a deathly ill cardiac patient. American skies were empty, yet at the same time, 140 Saudis were effectively chaperoned out of the country. The allegation is by the U.S. government among them. They weren't just any Saudis. Several dozen members of the bin Laden family. How is this possible? Well, this month, retired Chief White House aide Richard Clark revealed that top White House officials approved the evacuation of 140 influential Saudis, including members of the Osama bin Laden family, 2 days after the September 11th attack, at a time when all commercial and private flights were grounded. Clark, who ran the White House crisis team after the attacks, writes in the new issue of Vanity Fair that the FBI claimed none of the Saudis could be linked to the attacks, which were carried out by 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi. The New York Times reports this is the first public acknowledgement that the White House approved the controversial evacuation plan. We're joined right now by Craig Unger, who is the reporter on this piece for Vanity Fair and author of the forthcoming book, House of Bush, House of Saud. Can you explain what Vice President Cheney was saying he did not know about?
Well, it's interesting. The administration has not commented at all on this. They've Colin Powell was also asked about it the previous week, and he sort of said, well, we orchestrated something, but I don't really know the details. I think what's really, really important here is for the first time that there have been rumors of this departure beforehand of the Saudi repatriation, but for the first time, we know that Saudis were in the air when American airspace was locked down. This was the greatest national security crisis possibly in the history of the United States, and American skies were emptier than at any time since the days of the Wright brothers. Why is it that the Saudis were the most privileged people in the United States, including members of the bin Laden family? In any normal criminal investigation, even if it's a commonplace murder, it is normal to question the friends and relatives of the suspect. And here you had roughly 24 members of the bin Laden family who left without being interrogated or interviewed. And it really calls into the question why the administration has been so soft on the Saudis. 15 out of the 19 hijackers for 9/11 were Saudis. Increasingly, we've learned since 9/11 about a fairly big Saudi role in terrorism.
What was your reaction to Vice President Cheney's comment on Meet the Press this Sunday?
Well, reporting on this administration can be quite difficult because you don't really get much response. I tried the White House again and again. I had roughly 8 or 10 conversations with them. They would never speak to me. on the record. It was always on background, and then they denied that any such flights took place. Cheney himself simply says, I don't know. Well, the White House is either responsible or it's not responsible for this, or it's irresponsible. But other flights that were in the air at the same time that violated the lockdown were forced down by the American Air Force. You even had, as you mentioned, a man awaiting a heart transplant. His heart was for, replacement heart was, and the medical team with it, was forced down in midair. Why is it that there was this huge, huge rush to get the Saudis out? Officially, the Saudis have said, and to some extent what Cheney was said, is that there was a fear on the part of Saudis that there would be retribution by angry Americans. Now, there may have been such fear. At the same time, I never heard any incidents of mobs of angry Americans storming and actually threatening the Saudis.
We're talking to Craig Unger, who did the piece on Vanity Fair where a White House, well, explain exactly who Richard Clark is. This story has certainly been surfacing since September 11th, but it is the first time you've had any kind of White House confirmation that the White House was involved in flying many members of the bin Laden family out, as well as more than 100 Saudis. Also, the question of whether they were questioned at all. This is not about guilt, but it's about getting information.
Right. Richard Clark was the former White House counterterrorism czar, and he began in the administration of the elder George Bush. He survived through the Clinton years and continued to rise, and then he was in the administration of the current President George Bush, though he has since left and is now running a consulting firm in Virginia. But he's a man who is really considered nonpartisan. He's his own man. He speaks for himself. His question, his integrity is rather unquestioned. And I think partly because he had left the administration, he was far more candid than people I've been able to interview within the administration.
Can you talk about the subject of your next Bush, which is the link between the Bushes, the House of Bush and the House of Saud, going back to the trip of George Bush Sr., James Baker, representing the Carlyle Group, meeting with the Saudi family?
Right. Well, one thing that I think people have not explored, and this is what I hope will come out in my book next spring, is there's been a long-term relationship between the Bush family and the Saudis that really dates back more than 20 years when the elder Bush was vice president. He was very close friends with Prince Bandar, who is the Saudi ambassador to the United States. He's been ambassador for more than 20 years. He is a member of the royal House of Saud, the ruling family of Saudi Arabia. He is the nephew of King Fahd. His father, Prince Sultan, is defense minister. And they were very, very close friends during the 80s. Prince Bandar was actually active in the Iran-Contra scandal, helping funnel money to the Contras in Nicaragua in the 80s, in which Vice President Bush was then involved. Most recently, the Saudis have also been active in some of the oil companies owned by President Bush, such as Harkin Energy, in which President Bush was a member of the board of directors. The Saudis came in to help sort of bail them out in the late 80s. And most recently, you have the Carlyle Group, which is a giant private equity firm in Washington, D.C. It started in the late 80s. Now it's worth over $16 billion. And its principals and key figures include many of the great figures of the Reagan-Bush era. There's former President Bush. There's former Secretary of State James Baker. There's Richard Darman, who was head of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan-Bush era. Frank Carlucci, he was Secretary of Defense. Former Prime Minister John Major of England are all associated in one way or another with the Carlyle Group. And they bought up many, many defense companies. I think a lot of people may not know what a private equity firm is. but essentially they get involved in financial transactions such as leveraged buyouts, venture capital, real estate deals. They buy and sell companies. They try to buy them cheap, turn them around, and sell them in 3 to 5 years. And they raise money from both private investors of extremely high net worth and institutions like state pension funds. Well, much of their business went on with Saudi Arabia, and in the
In fact, the bin Ladens had millions sunk into the Carlyle Group, forced only to remove it, or at least that's as much as we know, after September 11th, with the embarrassment of Bush being one of their main ambassadors, Bush Sr. and James Baker, etc., and the bin Ladens funding this company.
Right. And in fact, on September 11th itself, the Carlyle Group was having a meeting that morning at the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C., and one of the bin Laden members, Shafiq bin Laden, who whose company has invested in Carlyle, was present while the attacks were taking place, as was Secretary of State James Baker.
And George Bush had just flown out earlier, President George Bush Sr. Last question, the response at Logan Airport, one of the places where the hijackers had flown from, when they were told that they, though all traffic was grounded, they were to allow a flight that took out Saudis and members of the bin Laden family, the response of officials at Logan Airport.
Well, they were stunned. I spoke with the director of aviation, Tom Kenton, and he simply couldn't believe it. And he said, how is it possible they're letting them go? Virginia Buckingham, who is head of Massport, which is the agency that oversaw Logan, was just agog. Here they were, the bin Ladens were on the tarmac, in the plane, they simply couldn't believe that they were being told to let them go without questioning.
And at the same time had grounded all other traffic.
Right. Well, at that point, commercial traffic was just resuming, but their private planes had been grounded.
Well, I want to thank you, Craig Unger, for being with us. That piece in this issue, the latest edition of Vanity Fair, looking at the Bushes and the bin Ladens. You are listening to Democracy Now! After a break, we move on to another statement of James Cheney this week. Stay with us. Fela Kuti singing International Teef Teef, ITT. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the case of Saudi Arabia, Vice President Cheney said it was irrelevant that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi. But in the case of Iraqis, Cheney used a different spin.
We know, for example, in connection with the original World Trade Center bombing in 93, that one of the bombers was Iraqi, returned to Iraq after the attack of 93. And we've learned subsequent to that, since we got into Baghdad and got into the intelligence files, that this individual probably also received financing from the Iraqi government as well as safe haven. Now, is there a connection between the Iraqi government and the original World Trade Center bombing in 93? We know, as I say, that one of the perpetrators of that act did, in fact, receive support from the Iraqi government after the fact.
Vice President Cheney is talking about Abdulrahman Yassin. He is listed among the FBI's top 25 most wanted. He's accused of participating in the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, has a $25 million bounty on his head. But there is a lot Cheney did not say about Yassin. First, he's an American citizen born in Bloomington, Indiana. Second, the FBI questioned Yassin shortly after the 93 bombing, characterized him as cooperative, and let him go. But what is perhaps most interesting is that when Yassin left the United States, he went to Iraq, where he lived for a year before being arrested by Iraqi intelligence agents in 1994. Last summer, 60 Minutes interviewed him in Baghdad in an Iraqi intelligence facility. It was the first time he was seen since the 93 attacks. Former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz told 60 Minutes that twice Iraq attempted to hand Yassin over to the United States, once in 94 under Clinton, and again after the attacks on September 11th. Aziz said in October of 2001, the Iraqi government sent word to the CIA through an Egyptian government emissary that an unnamed second government that Yassin was in custody in Iraq and that Baghdad wanted to hand him over. Aziz says the only condition was that the U.S. sign a receipt saying that Iraq had handed him over. The U.S. again rejected the offer, with officials later saying the Iraqis were placing too many demands on Washington in return for Yassin. Despite the comments of Cheney implying that Yassin shows a link between Iraq and attacks against the World Trade Center, he was not included in the Pentagon's deck of the 55 most wanted, despite the fact that he is listed on the FBI's top 25 most wanted list. Stephen Summerstein joins us, lawyer for Abdulrahman Yassin. Can you tell us about your client, Yassin? Were you surprised to hear Cheney raise him as a justification for the current attack on Iraq?
Well, surprised and not surprised. It seems that the government refers to Mr. Yassin anytime it's convenient for their own propaganda purposes.
I mean, you have Cheney saying that there is this man that Iraq has basically harbored all these years who is responsible for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And yet the information that he had been arrested, the U.S. authorities had released him. He went to Iraq. He was jailed in Iraq. Iraq tried to hand him over twice. And the U.S. under Bush and Cheney has refused to accept him and now does not even include him in this deck of cards, not to mention meaning saying he's not one of the most wanted, even though he's one of the FBI's 25 most wanted.
Well, our understanding is that, you know, he was indicted and was merely accused. There's never been a trial. He's never been convicted. The United States government has never produced or made public any real evidence against him. It's been my belief over the last 10 or so years that they find Mr. Yassin more valuable to them on the loose when they can just talk about him for their own purposes rather than actually bring him to trial where he might be acquitted. As far as we know, there's no real evidence linking him to the World Trade Center bombing.
Stephen Summerstein, the attorney for Abdulrahman Yassin. As we turn to the last statement of Dick Cheney that we will refer to today, this on Meet the Press on Sunday.
With respect to 9/11, of course, you've had the story that's been public out there. The Czechs alleged that Mohammed Atta, the lead attacker, met in Prague with a senior Iraqi intelligence official 5 months before the attack. But we've never been able to develop any more of that yet, either in terms of confirming it or discrediting it. We just don't know.
But we could establish a direct link between the hijackers of September 11th and Saudi Arabia.
We know that many of the attackers were Saudi. There was also an Egyptian in the bunch. That doesn't mean those governments had anything to do with that attack. That's a different proposition than saying the Iraqi government or the Iraqi intelligence service had a relationship with al-Qaeda that developed throughout the decade of the 90s. That was clearly official policy.
That is Vice President Dick Cheney speaking to Tim Russert on Meet the Press. Well, this story came shortly after 911, when Czech intelligence officials did say they had a report from a source, a single source, that Atta had met with an Iraqi intelligence official in April 2001 in Prague. Subsequent media reports in the United States revealed the source was actually an Arab student who is not considered particularly reliable. The FBI investigated, found nothing to substantiate the report of the meeting. In fact, the FBI concluded Atta was most likely in Florida at the time of the supposed meeting, and the CIA questioned the existence of this meeting. Also on October 21st, 2002, the New York Times reported that the Czech president, Václav Havel, said, quote, quietly told the White House he's concluded there is no evidence to confirm earlier reports of the meeting. And it seemed Atta had gone to Prague in June 2000, not April 2001. No, Cheney did not mention any of this on Meet the Press, nor did he note U.S. forces had nabbed this Iraqi intelligence official in July, and that there has been no word, no leaks about him confirming the supposed meeting. Chris Hedges is our last guest today, reporter for The New York Times. In December 2001, wrote an article for The Times entitled "The Nation Challenged Intelligence." Your comment on, once again, Vice President Dick Cheney raising this issue of Mohammed Atta meeting with an Iraqi official in Prague?
Well, of course, it's an old charge, one that was made, as you pointed out, by a very, frankly, not a very credible source. This was picked up on by the Czech prime minister at the time, who made a public statement about it and spoke to Americans about it. There was immediate backpedaling on the part of the Czech officials. Václav Havel, then president, personally conducted quite an exhaustive campaign out of his office to find out whether there was any substance to this charge at all, concluded that there was not. There are all sorts of, in the investigations that we did, there were all sorts of disparities. I mean, for instance, the meeting was supposed to have taken place in April of 2000, and from records that we have from, that American intelligence officials sort of spoke to us, that they put Atta in Virginia Beach, Virginia, in early April. He wasn't even in Prague. He did make a trip through Prague in June, very briefly, to make a connection to Newark, but the assumption is that this was because he could get a cheap ticket out of there, that there was no meeting. So this is something that's been reported on extensively in the New York Times and other papers. As you mentioned, I and reporter Don McNeil spent quite a bit of time interviewing intelligence officials in Europe, making trips to Prague, and I frankly had thought this had sort of been laid to rest and pretty much debunked.
What do you make of the vice president raising it again as one of the chief reasons for Iraq being invaded this past year?
Well, I think I was surprised to hear it, because even at the time that we were investigating it and the interviews that were done with American intelligence officials, they cast a lot of doubt about that claim. I mean, they were very reluctant to embrace it, and I think they, and as you pointed out, not only initially were they doubtful about the claim, but then when they looked into it as well, they decided that there was no credible evidence to make that charge. And you had a tenant who told Congress that the CIA could find no evidence to confirm that the meeting took place.
That's the director of Central Intelligence,
right,
George Tenet.
In October of 2002.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Chris Hedges, for joining us, reporter for The New York Times, author of What Every Young Person Should Know About War, and War is a Force Which Gives Us Meaning. And that does it for the show. If you want to get a copy, call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.